Dr. William S. Banowski has been president of Pepperdine University since 1971. He received his Bachelor of Arts degree from David Lipscomb College in Tennessee, his Master of Arts from the University of New Mexico, and received a PhD in communications from the University of Southern California. He's the director of the Independent Colleges of Southern California, the Automobile Club of Southern California, the National Conference of Christians and Jews, the Coca-Cola Company of Los Angeles, and was formerly the Republican National Committee Man for the State of California. His published works include three books: It's a Playboy World, The Mirror of a Movement, and The New Generation. Dr. William S. Banowski.
Thank you, Mike. I assume from that precipitous finish that we are observing time limitations carefully, and so I'll try to do as well. Should I quit it in the middle of the sentence? Okay. Throughout much of the past 200 years, the spectacular development of our nation has been propelled by an idea called the American Dream. In recent years, however, the dream seems to have been shattered. What did we mean by the American Dream? What happened to it? Can it be recovered? One does not discover a tidy definition of the American Dream in any dictionary or encyclopedia. That's because this dream is not some easy ism, but an ideal, an aspiration, a set of values. The dictionary is crammed with words like Americanism, communism, anti-disestablishmentarianism, and 100 others. Americanism, for instance, is defined as attachment or loyalty to the United States, its traditions, interests, or ideals. But what precisely are those interests, traditions, and ideals? In 1961, Edward Albee wrote a play called The American Dream, and 2 years later, Norman Mailer published a novel by the same name. But rather than defining our national past, much less celebrating it, these very forgettable diatribes mostly apologized for it. No one can say for certain, I think, just when this moving phrase, the American Dream, first came into existence. Like most dreams, we probably found ourselves in the midst of it long before we were self-conscious enough to analyze it. Walt Whitman and Mark Twain, Thomas Jefferson and Tom Paine, Samuel Gompers, Woodrow Wilson, and a host of poets, politicians, reformers, and patriots conceived it and helped nourish and expand it. But who has ever really defined it? At its very heart, of course, the American Dream has to do with freedom, individual liberty. Archibald MacLeish touched this heart when he wrote, "There are those, I know, who will say that the liberation of humanity, the freedom of man and mind, is nothing but a dream." It is. It is the American Dream. In the 17th century, as men and women first began to arrive on this continent in those tiny wooden ships, mankind's ageless quest for freedom took a quantum leap forward. Because while we had always struggled for greater liberty, at last, the yearning itself became partners with a new, incredible opportunity. Freedom plus opportunity. The chemistry was explosive. One of the most impressive explanations for the development of America as a nation, and one which I think is frequently neglected, is an idea called the frontier thesis. It was developed principally by the distinguished Harvard historian Frederick Jackson Turner. Turner's frontier thesis, simply put, is that the uniqueness of this country resided in its vast real estate. We had been given unlimited room to grow. For centuries, our European ancestors had been rigidly confined by economic and political boundaries which were partially determined by geographical limitations. But suddenly, the colonies of Virginia and Georgia provided larger territory than all of the countries of Great Britain combined. As the sons and daughters of the original settlers sought their own personal expression, there was always plenty of room to the west. The Louisiana Purchase, for instance, added a territory greater than all of Western Europe. for centuries, men who had been conditioned to repeat the social and occupational patterns of the class to which they were born were at last born free. In providing unparalleled opportunity, the frontier also demanded a toughening of the human spirit. Some of the lessons of survival were learned from the American Indians. The industrious and determined were rewarded. The weak and unwilling were harshly punished. The most enterprising were the most successful. Only the fittest survived. The frontier was the line of Americanization, wrote Professor Turner. The wilderness mastered the colonist. It took him from the railroad car and put him in a birch canoe. It stripped off the garments of civilization and arrayed him in the hunting shirt and the moccasin. He accepted the conditions or he perished. Little by little, he transformed the wilderness, but the outcome was not the old Europe. There was a new product that was America. The premium was on self-sufficiency, and as the country developed, it was not the European parlors, the rugged farms and woods which prepared the national leadership. Lincoln emerged from the very edge of civilization, but the sophisticated Van Buren was also born in a log cabin. Jackson, Harrison, Polk, Taylor, all were from the very frontier of their times. Even the learned Jefferson was born on a farm in Virginia when that region was remote from the coastal settlements. Of Lincoln, James Russell Lowell observed, "Nothing of Europe here. New birth of this soil, the first America." So those who felt constrained in Massachusetts moved on to Missouri. Weary shopkeepers settled the farmlands of the Midwest. When room ran out in the established states, the hardy homesteaded Oklahoma. And for the truly adventurous, there was gold in the hills of California and Colorado. And the vast, rugged Northwest was always there. The American dream, then, was no set of dogmas. It was fashioned from many fabrics. It was a chorus of dreams. That's why it's been so vital and productive. That's also why it has never been completely harmonious. As Jackson Turner put it, to the frontier, the American intellect owes its striking characteristics, that coarseness and strength, that dominant individualism, that buoyancy and exuberance which comes from freedom. These are the traits of the frontier. Now, somewhere along the way, the American dream seems to have lost some of its steam and much of its buoyancy and exuberance. When I was a college student in the tranquil 1950s, the dream was still alive and well. Nobody had ever heard of Alvin Toffler, and very few of us of Vietnam. Elvis Presley and the hula hoop provided our greatest excitement. And the father figure everybody seemed to like was our president. Still in its innocence, America had never lost a war, and there seemed to be no limitations on our ability to measure up to domestic challenges. The Great Depression, once so threatening, was now only further proof of our complete mastery. So we all went to work in furtherance of the dream. College degree guaranteed economic security, and the really big rewards were available for those willing to pay the price. Just work hard and get ahead. It really didn't make much difference whose head. And as we eyed the moon, not even the sky itself was any longer the limit. The folksy slogan that any American boy can grow up to be president was just one of the many pep talks. The chilling contrast between the way we were and the way we are was brought home to me recently by my 14-year-old son, Bill Jr. "The difference, Dad," he said, "is that today no boy wants to be president." Whatever happened to the American dream occurred somewhere between my son's decade of the 1970s and my own tranquil 1950s. There was, you remember, a colorful, crunching cataclysm in between. The young people who enrolled in our colleges during the 1960s were the first generation of Americans who could no longer believe completely in the American dream. For purposes of perspective, it would be helpful to draw the contrast between the optimism at the opening of this century and the despair which has engulfed so many of late. In 1900, this country regarded itself as God's elect. We believe that an almost divinely delivered purpose called Manifest Destiny. At the opening of this century, we were planning for universal peace and prosperity and brotherhood. Herbert Spencer had developed a theory of social evolution promising the perfectibility of the human race. With triumphant, if naive, confidence in the fundamental goodness of human nature, we believed that we were all getting better and better day by day. With a kind of global evangelism, we yearned to share our dream with all mankind. I have a little book in which the author argues impressively that war is an outdated relic from the barbaric past. It was published in 1907. When Woodrow Wilson, in whose idealistic heart the American dream was never any purer, committed us to the first war, we were so confident of our total control of the future that we labeled it the war to end all wars. But somewhere along the line, we lost our confidence and started numbering. The young men who died in Vietnam in a tragic bloodbath, which bitterly exposed the deep confusion in the American soul, were the grandsons of the men who sailed away in 1917 to make the world forever safe for democracy. So what we've experienced, as the poll takers now daily verify with endless empirical evidence, is a collapse of confidence, not only in the American political parties, but in all American institutions, government, religion, business, the media, education. In some ways, our sense of betrayal at the hands of education has been most devastating because our supreme confidence in education was part and parcel of the American dream. We celebrate the bicentennial, but we must go back to 1636, almost another century and a half, to the founding of the first American college at Harvard. As Frederick Lewis Allen points out in his delightful book, Only Yesterday, by the early 1900s, sophisticated Americans placed more confidence in the efficacy of education than in the promises of religion. Only given enough time to expose everybody to a liberal arts education, and we would solve all of the problems of the human race. It was not some politician or preacher who most profoundly shaped the cult of progress, but the brilliant educational philosopher John Dewey. The new gospel was salvation by education, and we committed ourselves to the most extensive program of mass higher education in the history of mankind. After building 2,500 colleges and universities, we have lately begun to wonder. It was something of a setback when, during the Second World War, the most terrible atrocities were not perpetrated by some banana republic, but exploded from the very heart of Central Europe at the hands of a nation which had produced so much of the world's best literature, science, music, and theology. But the really breathtaking blows for the average American, sending his children to college so they could have it made, came a generation later at places like Berkeley, Columbia, and Kent State. Not only were the age-old problems still with us long after they were to have been solved, but they were emanating from the very centers of our salvation. If one could no longer believe in the value of higher education, what was left? The American dream had become a ghoulish nightmare. With the vanishing of the dream, we have experienced a massive shift of confidence away from the cognitive or the knowing process toward the affective or the feeling process. Astrology is taken more seriously than political parties. Many people take astrology seriously with PhDs. Sensitivity training sessions are the rage. Everything has to be at gut level, by which we mean, look, don't bother me with what you think or with what the book says, because I want something I can trust. You tell me how you feel. The technical word for this syndrome is existentialism. Philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, whose view of life has led many young people toward nihilism, are the prophets for the new mood. At a lower level, people like Cher Bono or Michael Caine capture the popular fancy, as did the song Caine popularized. What's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live? The advertisers, always among the very first to sense what's really going on, exhort, you just go this way one time, you better grab all the gusto you can, even in the beer you drink. Inevitably, it filters down to the bumper stickers, like the one recommending, if it feels good, do it. And so a lot of people have dropped out of active participation in political parties to do their own thing. And lately, that has not included even taking the time to vote. In the national elections of 1974, less than 45% of the electorate voted. The current governor of California is in office with a mandate from only 23% of the state's qualified citizens. We'll do little good to address the problem of disillusionment at the surface level. Where do we go? Our hope for the future lies in a recovery of perspective. Our predicament is not unlike the man who, when asked, "How's your wife?" replied, "Well, compared to what?" To see things in relationship is a philosophical breakthrough. As with any dream in much of our national past, we may not have been fully awake to reality. Shortly before his death, Arnold Toynbee observed last year, "America still has a fighting chance," he said, "if it can just get over the idea of an earthly paradise." Today, no sane person thinks he's living in any kind of a paradise. But nonetheless, we face the disillusionment of paradise lost. What we may need is a national psychiatrist. How does a nation regain its confidence and self-respect, its nerve, its sense of purpose? As Eric Hoffer put it, it's easy to be full of rage. It's not so easy to go to work and build something. It is the old line liberal who now faces the deepest intellectual problem. Young Brown may be able to put together a patchwork of pragmatic pattern for a time, but the holes are already beginning to show. The total faith in the ubiquitous efficacy of government, fervently held since the New Deal days, is shattered. The intellectual conservative, while very frustrated about forming a coalition with his social counterparts with blue collars, at least can feel some philosophical vindication. The first step demands the frank admission that we dreamed too much, expected too much, believed that through the omnipotence of our federal government we were capable of doing too much. The age of innocence is past. There will never be a war to end wars. We can just hope that the next one is not one using hydrogen weapons. We will never be able to produce enough wheat to feed all the world starving or tax ourselves enough to buy the friendship of every needy nation. The agony of New York City looms as grim contemporary evidence. We simply cannot pay public employees 100% pensions. The city cannot sustain a giant university with 19 campuses where none of the 225,000 students pays any tuition whatsoever without placing unbearable demands upon the taxpayers. If today New York City were to close down half its hospitals, it would still have 9 times more hospital beds than the city of Chicago. There is no finer example of the problem of the materialistic American dream than New York City. In the sense, then, of ever creating an earthly paradise, the dream is over. But having conceded that, we must now go forward to preserve the precious thrust which the dream provided, recognizing that while its capabilities were overstated, most of its underlying principles are as valid as ever. We seek then not a revival of a dream, but a new American vision. What specifically should it be? First, if perspective demands a clear-cut view of our vulnerabilities, it also demands a grateful appreciation of the richness of our past. To see ourselves as we really are will bring as much pleasure as pain. Let's begin positively by acknowledging that we are indeed the greatest nation in the world, relatively speaking. It will be extremely difficult to swallow our pride and confess that despite what we may have believed about manifest destiny and all the rest, we were never God's chosen elect. We were not, any more than mortal beings ever have been, completely the masters of our own fate. We did not pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. We were, in fact, enormously lucky. We were lucky to stumble onto so much open territory, as Turner has pointed out, lavish in natural resource. We were blessed to have been preceded by a founding generation which included some of history's keenest political minds who were pulled together by time and circumstance to devise history's greatest political system. Furthermore, we were fortunate when all of this conspired perfectly with the arrival of industrialization and technology. If indeed the hand of Providence moved in our affairs at all, it would be that the combination of place and people and resources provided an opportunity unique in world history. Our Constitution was not delivered from some political Sinai. It was grafted by gifted mortals, and it is only the best one yet, relatively speaking. When first drawn, it provided that only white adult males with certain property holdings could vote. Blacks received no legal recognition until the 14th and 15th Amendments. Women couldn't vote until 1920. It was not the perfection of the Constitution, but the wisdom of the framers to build in the amending capacity which has held us together. The recovery of perspective is already healing some of our wounds. Eldridge Cleaver is an unlikely champion of the American dream, but his wife, explaining his recent decision to return from abroad, even at the price of prison, had this to say. He had come to understand that the structural form of individual liberty enjoyed by the American citizen is greater than in any other country. There is no multiracial society in which the economic and political representation of the black members is equal to that of blacks in America, from Mrs. Cleaver. Today, a higher proportion of black Americans goes to college than do white Europeans. 400,000 people immigrate to this country every year legally, thousands more illegally. And the flow the other way is a tiny trickle. If we are a sick and corrupt society, it is only by comparison to the standards that we set for ourselves, not by comparison to reality as it exists now or ever has existed anywhere else in the world. While consumer prices have gone up 23% in this country during the past 2 years, they've risen 49% in Britain, 40% in Japan, 41% in Italy, 28% in France. Unemployment appears shamefully high in the United States compared with the Soviet Union, where joblessness is all but non-existent. But appearances are deceiving. Russia has compulsory labor laws. You take whatever job is offered by the state at wages that are only a fraction of those prevailing here, or you face prison or exile. My prescription for the new American vision includes the following: a humble admission of our limitations, along with an awareness that we must always live in an imperfect world. The facility not to take ourselves so seriously, and to cultivate a sense of humor. A constant, unrelenting effort to limit and control the power and cost of government at all levels. A strong national defense, second to none, in recognition of the real world in which we live, which includes the congenital evil within human nature. A deeper appreciation of the unique greatness of our political system and a rededication to its preservation. A greater and deeper participation by all citizens at all levels of government, a clearer understanding that freedom is indivisible, including economic freedom, and that without the preservation of the private competitive economy, none of our dreams will have come true. My view is that the crisis we face in the political parties is a crisis we face in terms of American identity. I believe this to be verified in my experience among young people. And if I were giving one other part of the prescription, I would say that we must restore the spiritual vision, which at its moments of finest expression was at the heart of the American dream. Our globe is divided into two basic philosophies of life, each one really stemming from radically different assumptions about the nature of man. We have already conceded too much of the battle by choosing to fight on our opponent's home territory, largely with the weapons of his choosing. Communism is a forthright religion of materialism, which begins with the premise that man's purpose is to get all he can and leads to the conclusion that this can best be accomplished through a concentration of all power in the state. The individual exists, therefore, for the good of the state, since it is the business of the state to supply for all individuals material goods and services. The roots of our dream run radically in the opposite direction. We began from the faith that the ultimate unit in the universe is the individual, that each person is of intrinsic dignity, that all persons are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. The American dream is never more grotesque than when it degenerates into a materialistic struggle, and we are never weaker in facing the Soviets than when we do so without the fundamental spiritual cornerstone of our heritage. Where did we get the notion of individual liberty and personal freedom? If life has no transcendent spiritual purpose, but is it rather a purely utilitarian struggle to create the best materialistic society, by what objective standards are Hitler and Stalin to be judged venal? The plain truth is that the very essence of the American dream, the freedom and dignity of each person, derives immediately from the revealed religion of our Judeo-Christian heritage. Without insisting upon some fundamentalistic theology, the basic foundation of our society will be shattered if we abandon the belief that somehow and in some way we have been created in His image. The communists obviously believe their vision of materialism provided by the awesome power and control of the state. People who believe nothing are not going to be a match for an opponent of passionate conviction. If our vision of the future does not contain at its heart a transcendent spiritual conviction, then we not only can provide to the people of the world no real live option, but we have already surrendered the fight and are but waiting to be buried. In God we trust is across the top of the United States Senate and on all our coins. This was not a cliche thrown in by the founding fathers to placate a few other worldly representatives. It was the very core of our conviction that the ultimate inviolate unit in the universe is not a committee or a government, but the individual person. Where else do these certain rights originate? And how else shall they be preserved apart from the conviction that all men and women are endowed by their Creator?